been a long day, I guess. So this is just a bit of a lazy finish. It's a non-code orientated, but a more production orientated. If you were building requirements, information architecture, how that would translate. This is a talk I gave at Oz IA.
Puffed, mate.
What? I'm puffed. Jesus, hopeless, isn't it? Can't talk and walk. All right, so some of these things that I'll just race through the slides and just get to the meat of it. But we talk about content objects. We talk about this not just in terms of Far Cry, but also in terms of the approach that we use to building large-scale applications. So it's something we use for describing larger content management solutions or larger applications, but I think it's also useful for describing smaller applications. So object-orientated, it's a little bit aimed at people who aren't familiar with programming terms. This is, I'm a new father, so this is Isabella's little feet. Oh, all these little things there. So object, obviously, is just a thing. Type or class is a template for these objects. And really what it boils down to is the sense of a content type and a content object. And so when we look at the sort of individual case studies I'm talking about today, which are Vancouver 2010 and UNSWTV, we're looking at things like an Olympic athlete is a content type. An example of that would be Dale Beck-Smith. He's a gold medalist, by the way. Australia, you wouldn't believe, have gold medalists in the Olympics. He's an import from Canada. So.
Is that the one where everyone else fell over?
No, this is the guy who actually won his award when he was in Canada and came to Australia. So that's the classic. So Olympic sport, something like freestyle skiing, so on. News report, et cetera, et cetera. In the case of UNSWTV, we've got videos, we've got collections of media, faculties, schools, and the like. So classic kind of model view control, the diagram. This is one of my favourite views of model view is this cartoon. I think this is really classically describes the whole model view concept where you have this model sitting behind the walls, something that you actually want to see. There's a controller which is the thing that the user is interacting with. And finally, based on his interaction, he gets to see something of the model behind the scenes. It's a classic. So developer mindset, really, we try and get people when we're building stuff in our own teams who are not on the development team, that are actually providing wireframes and so on, to get to grips with what's going to happen once it does get translated to the coding side of things. So by developing in this kind of concept of content objects for information architecture, we really hope to make the kind of communication between requirements gathering at the client end and the interpretation of those requirements at the developer end a lot kind of smoother. So I'm getting to grips with some content objects, some examples of that. So when we talk about content objects and requirements gathering, it's very similar to any other sort of standard information architecture stuff. We look at talking to the client, working out what it is they actually want. And for us, paper prototyping or wireframing is a really critical part of any sort of project that we get involved in. And we don't really start development at all until we've kind of mapped down on paper a sort of a blueprint for how we think the site's going to look. It's not necessarily the final product, but it's certainly something that's had a great deal of discussion in terms of, you know, how things will progress in terms of the workflow of the UI, the different views that we're going to see, and so on. So in terms of Far Cry, we are determining the content types, those things that are the business objects that are going to map to the model, and we're determining individual views that are going to be represented by Far Cry. And this leads down to our technical and kind of visual design brief that we'll give both the development team and the designers. And a lot of people, I think, mistakenly focus on the concept of a site hierarchy. You've got this site map, a mud map, or essentially a kind of a tree diagram detailing all the different areas of the website. And they obsess about this particular aspect of especially website design, but also any kind of web application development. And you always end up with these cute little stacks. I don't know what programs they use, but they always almost have invariably some sort of little stack that represents, you know, danger, too difficult to interpret, developers are here type thing, which ultimately are things like, you know, lots of news items, or there'll be a bunch of Olympic sports, or there'll be athletes, or whatever it might be. So for us, we kind of dispense with the site hierarchy and look purely at the explicit relationships between individual content types in the system first. So we obviously have to do a site hierarchy and look at how the individual menus are going to be modelled and so on. But the actual guts of the programming really revolves around how the primary kind of pools of content are going to interact with each other. And you think of it that way, like a pool, it's like this kind of deep pool of content that's sitting out there, a deep pool of knowledge. And the site hierarchy is just a tree that kind of dips its roots down into that pool and provides a guided path for users accessing the site to go to key areas of that content that you're interested in. Like a key area of news, for example, is the latest news. There might be thousands of news items in there, but your guided path almost always takes you to the latest news. And the same is true for any website. Typically, there's only so much you can show in the primary nav, and it's nearly always a guided path for one particular customer group or another. So, content object foo, the kind of way of content objects, we always base any page. So if we look at a website, any page you're looking at is always related to a specific content type or a specific instance of that content type. So remember, Far Cry always executes a view in the context of an object in the model. And so whenever we look at a paper prototype or a wireframe, we're always thinking, what on earth is the content type that will be executed when this particular page is run? So pages are commonly, almost always, a composite view of the primary content type and a view on the explicit relationships that particular content has with other items in the system. So when we talk about relationships, we're really keen, and this in the information architecture world, a lot of people get agitated about debates about explicit, implicit relationships. Funny kind of set of debates to have, I think, but anyway. We favour explicit relationships. If a contributor can be forced to make a direct relationship between two objects, that's great. You know, this sport has the following athletes. This news item is about the following topic. These sort of explicit relationships are very important. Implicit relationships, all too often these days, are what people find themselves with because they haven't really architected an application that works particularly well. These are things like tags. Whenever you see tags floating around, these are implicit relationships. So two content items can have the same set of tags and be in the tag cloud somewhere. But they're really pointing to this third object, the keyword, to form their relationship. It's kind of an indirect relationship, or an implied relationship between them. And this can be bad. Imagine you're looking at an article on, kids watching TV become violent, or the latest Samsung LED TV. These two things both mention TV. They're completely and utterly unrelated to each other, and you very often see these sort of relationships. In fact, it astounds me that news sites only just in the last year and a half have started to provide explicit relationships between related articles. Almost always in the past, you know, City Morning Herald, News, any of these places, they almost always had things like related keyword articles or nothing, absolutely nothing. Whereas, I mean, they're providing editorial day to day. It's madness. But
what's more about it? They've actually put the workflow in to make the list.
Yeah, they don't have the opportunity. The system doesn't allow it. Yeah. So Far Cry, one of the big strengths of that is providing these explicit relationships is easy. It's easy to build the UI for it. It's easy to build the edit handlers for it. It should just be part of your makeup, constantly thinking about allowing contributors to participate in building those relationships. So in summary, we're focused on relationships between content types. The site hierarchy, we're kind of thinking about that at the end rather than at the beginning. So how does this apply in the real world? Well, we showed you briefly Vancouver before, so I wanted to just go through a couple of these pages in Vancouver and just kind of tie everything up. You know, the things we've been talking about, these types with their type web skins which show lists of objects, individual objects, and a view on that particular individual object and its relationships. So, first example I have is a wireframe for sports. So inside Vancouver we have all these winter sports that people participate in. This page is focused on what content type? Sport. Okay, so too easy. But it's a list of sports, so it must be a view which is a type view or a list of objects. And indeed, we just go in, call a function, grab all the active sports, and we loop over the teaser views of these sports and render them out onto the page.
So when you say, so that's what you mean when you say type view, because you're really talking about this like static.
Correct, like a static method.
Okay, right.
The problem is type comes up all over the place. So we kind of wrestle with the terminology internally. We try and say maybe we should call it a list view or a collection view or something which implies that it's a view on a collection of objects rather than an actual instance of an object. of course, doesn't have to be a view on anything other than something related to that content type. So when we actually drill down to a specific sport itself, and this is an actual wireframe from the build for Vancouver 2010, you can see we're looking at a sport. It's a kind of a primary landing page view for that specific sport. In this case, it's fairly high fidelity. It's got actual information about curling and so on. And we're referencing in kind of call-outs exactly how these things ought to be built. The nice thing is that I think this is quite a good kind of site to look at the sort of things we've been talking about, in that we have clearly the headers and the footers. This is actually something that's relatively static for everything to do with curling. But these individual tabs, for example, may change based on which body view you're calling for that specific page. So the layout is the same, but you'll be calling in a body view to show the About tab, or the Curling News tab, or the Schedule and Results tab. And we can determine which of those views comes to the fore based on the view that's been nominated on the URL, for example, to show in this particular instance. These relationships, remember we talk about it being a composite view of the relationships of this content type, are nice and clearly defined. Those members of the curling team, the curling news that's most recent, results history, the federation they're attached to, and so on. If you have any questions, please shout out. Just me chewing the fat. So this is an interesting decision about curling news. Obviously focused on the content type of the winter sport, and this happens to be curling and the related news items. But we could just as easily have made a decision to focus on news instead. And so you could have been looking at a page dedicated to news and actually have some kind of a view on the relationship with curling that shows news items associated with curling. So, again, it depends on the site. You may never have that decision, but we make an absolute point of saying, okay, this news associated with curling is based on the winter sport content type, and we have a view specifically which shows the relationship to news. And so as we're planning that larger application out, these are the kinds of decisions that we're making as we go through that planning stage. Last but not least, the schedule. The schedule's a little bit weird in that we pull this from an external party. We pull the schedule information, the start list, like who's in each and every race, the results of each of those races. We in fact pull those because they're so complicated. We pull them as PDF summaries and import them and provide references so that when they come through, you'll see a start list appear here and then a results item appear here as soon as that feed's constantly updated in the background. If there's a change in the schedule, it'll automatically change. So we're pulling this third-party data, we're binding it to a content item in the system based on the schedule and individual event records, and then again, it's a view on curling, which looks at the relationship to the results and schedule. And that's the kind of final page we have coming up. I won't bother to switch to the website, but I could switch to the website later if anybody wants to see any specific aspects of it. And again, the same again, for athletes. If we look at a specific athlete, this is a page about Team Australia. In the Vancouver site, we can only show details about Australian athletes. The IOC won't let us show details about any other athlete. In fact, if you ever get a chance to work with the Olympics, it's one of the most bizarrest kind of weird set of restrictions. You know, we can only show to Australian audiences. We have to geo-block everybody who's not Australia. And it's bizarre. It really is quite odd in terms of what we're allowed to show. But content type is the athlete. The view is a type web skin showing all athletes, or a collection of athletes. And underneath we have a landing page for the athlete. And again, a series of views, slightly different layout now, about the athlete's specific schedule, the athlete's specific news, their biography and a blog that they might be working on. But again, it's nice. It's the same set of content types, but from an information architecture point of view, we're saying focus on the athlete, and now show the relationship to the schedule rather than the other way around. Show the relationship for news. Show the relationship to the blog that's there. So, incidentally, when it starts running, it's probably the best place on earth to get details about individual athletes. You can go here and see your athlete that you like and actually see every event that they're appearing in specifically. Or you can look at the general event page and it highlights any event an Australian athlete is participating in. So if you're one of these, you know, classic Australians, only watch the Olympics to see Australians compete, then it's a perfect place to go because it's constantly highlighting and focusing those athletes that are representative in the Australian team, which is surprisingly quite a few in the Winter Olympics. So we have all these random imports from all over the place, but yeah, Australians love winter sports. News. Sorry? We have like some of the craziest women on earth doing the, you know, the skeleton and luge thing.
It's crazy.
And videos of it. All the video, because we built an Australian Olympic media gallery too, which imports all the video files from here. So if you want to see some crazy stuff with people kind of shooting down, you can see all of that. The only other people in Australia that will be competing with us is Foxtel. We also run a blogging plugin. So we have, Far Cry has an open source single blogging platform, which can run standalone or run embedded inside a Far Cry app. For Vancouver and a couple of other clients actually at the moment, we're building version 2 of that, which is a multi-blog, multi-author publishing platform for blogging. So in this particular case, there are a selection of the Australian athletes have their own diary, which is effectively a blog. I think this is a nice example. We have an XML feed that comes from a third party, which gives us a lot of this bio data, which is then hybrid with a Far Cry content type. So we import a lot of data into the Far Cry content type and build an edit handler that doesn't allow you to edit those fields so that the remote source is the source of truth, and then provide a series of additional fields which can be edited locally so that these guys have a lot more control over what's going on. Obviously, the third party, it's pretty tough to control that data coming in, but now they can just supplement that data. And in many instances, we do things like, if there's nothing in the local database, just use the generic stuff that's coming from the third party. Otherwise, use the local stuff. And so they can put in things like alerts, and, you know, this person's broken their leg and has been thrown from the shadow team, or whatever sort of stuff is relevant for them on the day.
How long did it take you to build the application?
For Vancouver? I don't know. What do you reckon? Vancouver was a 12-week project, really. But we got killed. We were stoned to death. Death by a thousand cuts. I don't know if you've ever had that with clients, but not that Vancouver necessarily are a bad client. They're not a bad client. They're just, they're just difficult at times in terms of they don't tell us what they need until it's too late. We've already built something else. It's kind of like that. And it's like, but, and you're like, how? There's only so much you can document. There's only so much protection you can give yourself. And the problem for us is we didn't want to fight them in many instances because we wanted to make it a beautiful site. We want it as a showcase site. We all love it and we're proud of it and it's marvellous and all the rest of it. But in the end, you get kind of, you know, killed on the detail. The XML feed we're given has only 10 properties. And when we get it, it's actually got 50 properties. And they want random 36 of them displayed. They won't tell us what they are in advance. And so on, you know what I mean? So you write one thing, and so we're lucky in that we have a lot of flexibility with the view and we can change these things rapidly. It's just when you have to make 100 5-minute changes, it starts to really kill you. Because to get geared up to make the change, to put it in, put it into version control, check it out, to, you know, it starts to become really difficult. So there's a media gallery. I mean, I don't know if you've seen the media gallery. It's just another Far Cry app which is separate to the whole sort of scheme of things here. I think this is a great case study. I've been lobbying Adobe to do something about a case study on, you know, local Olympics. But I think maybe it's because we're in Australia, I don't know. But it's not interesting enough. But never know. I just wanted to quickly show you the mad, crazy... Case Moljak. We need to get her on the case. She's no doubt get us up there with Western Australia, that's for sure. I wanted to show... Oh, I could tell you what I should do. It should be here. I just wanted to show you this crazy people who do the mad luge event called the Skeleton.
I'm amazed that the Olympics would let you near the Olympics after all of those comments you put in the Cold Fusion Developer Study Guide.
Oh, did you? I love the Confusion Sally guy. What did I say at the Olympics? Oh, I'm just quoting Roy and HG.
You're quoting Roy and HG all the way through the country. Spin the date.
Party date. There
party
was no
date.
Spinning the date.
Hello.
Jesus.
Skeleton is basically face first down the bobsled track. All we wear is a lycra, long sleeve, long leg, speedo suit, like the swimmers race in. So
Damn Melbourne Uni and their thing. This is... no streaming. It's served directly off Amazon S3. And that's a nice feature. It's one of the big features in Far Cry 5.2 that's...
What, like, less than, like, half a millimetre thick? We wear a helmet and a mouth guard.
It's pretty crazy.
We're lucky we get to wear socks, but usually our coach doesn't allow it, so we wear spikes, much like...
It's truly the craziest thing you've ever seen. So you're flying down a 1 mil wetsuit on an ice chute at God knows how many miles
Travel
per hour.
Sprinting spikes, except it's a brush bottom, so it's heaps and heaps of little spikes in the chute.
Damn you. Should be streaming. We'd love it to be streaming. Flash Media Service too expensive though, so can't do it. Interestingly enough, that is a problem.
What I love about skeleton is the speed and the adrenaline. And every single time you go to the top of the track.
So it's all there to see. It's beautiful. I was going to say Flash Media Server, lean, mean Flash Media Serving machine is what you need out there. Is there something that you guys could do for me? What's the story? Have you got a Wowser from Adobe rather than the whole kit and caboodle, just the streaming bit?
Have you explained to Ben how UNSW TV is hosted? It's all everywhere?
It's awesome. UNSW TV is like the most awesome infrastructure. I've got a slide I'll show you when we get to that particular area, which we're on to now.
Why didn't you use Red 5? Because Red 5 is Linux.
We didn't actually have we weren't responsible for the choice of the media server. Could have used Red 5. The Wowser thing was open source with commercial support. And they could, well, it's a streaming server which basically rips off Flash Media Server, effectively. And it must be tough building server products which people keep reverse engineering and releasing for free. I think it must be really hard to innovate and try and... So I feel for Adobe in that area. But
recover your investment.
Yeah, well, hard to recover, yeah. So let me just quickly show you the UNSW behind the scenes, because it's great to see big stuff, you know, being... how it all sort of comes together in the end.
Is that the slide you showed in the review?
Yeah, it would have been, actually. So... this is the actual infrastructure. If I put that up, this is a simplified version of the infrastructure, but it's quite cool. Effectively, Amazon is where everything runs at the moment. They had this plan of running everything locally inside the university. The infrastructure team failed to deliver the infrastructure in time, and they also undercharged. I think it was somewhere in the region of 10 times the value that Amazon were charging. And we had the whole thing staged already in Amazon, so we basically had all of this environment staged and hosted there for development purposes, and we said, well, we could turn it on if you want to as a temporary measure, and it's been a temporary measure now for 11 months. We have a scheduled build to move all of that internally. It's now November. I don't know when that's going to happen, but it's supposed to be happening now. I just think, you know, the universities often are like government clients sometimes, where they have some key areas which are great and people are focused and they want success, and other areas where people don't seem to care whether they're success or failure. And that seems to be the section of, I'll give them 4 weeks to see how we go. But it's been difficult, essentially. We repatriate all of that content once it's been transcoded, because we have a big transcoding engine which we built in FFmpeg, and a message queue in ColdFusion. Not Event Gateway, but a full-on message queue in ColdFusion we called the Simple Message Queue, which is a Far Cry plugin which runs all of these events that occur asynchronously going through the transcoding process, which is, again, fun to talk about. So depending if people are interested, I'll talk about that.
The transcoding process was only an interim solution
That's right. We had the transcoding. Do you want to hear the full pitch
Yes.
Okay. So I'll give you the quick rundown, because I did this presentation at... this particular one I did at... the University Higher Education Conference. They had all the IT managers for, 18 different universities, and we're talking about them. This is what we did for UNSW TV. They're all trying to move towards this particular area, which is essentially a kind of unified publishing system that allows not just staff and faculty, but everybody to be able to publish stuff. It's a service. It's not just a YouTube. It's literally something that people can use to transcode, do all the post-production on their video, and then actually publish it to multiple locations. So it was difficult, you know, everybody was leaving stuff at the front door of their e-learning team to get this online, and they had three individual publishing points they wanted to get to. University of New South Wales' own portal, iTunes U, which is a dedicated university education area of iTunes, and also YouTube itself. And I think without Cold Fusion, it just wouldn't have been possible. We're doing, obviously all of our own stuff in Cold Fusion Unit Something TV, secure streaming, lockdown to individual course codes, just lockdown to faculty or school or staff or students, all these kinds of interesting things for security. iTunes U, we are interfacing with a web service directly with iTunes, which incidentally is one of the worst products I've ever seen. So iTunes behind the scenes is just a lousy piece of stuff. I can't believe Apple are involved with it, really, to be honest. But iTunes U, mainly done manually. We do it all via an API now. And YouTube too. We do it via secure FTP, XML payload, and a web service. So all of these things working behind the scenes in Cold Fusion. To get to iTunes, we need a special type of encryption to do all their login, which Cold Fusion Enterprise provides. It's pretty cool. So different environments. This is the kind of UNSW TV portal. iTunes U looks a little bit like this. Each university has their own dedicated environment where they can list courses and do podcasts and so on. And obviously YouTube is, again, something you can customise. They have about three different channels on YouTube. Interestingly enough, you only get one username password to log on to YouTube. And so if you want to kind of share that process of publishing out to YouTube for a university, it's very difficult. You end up with a bottleneck on a team that's responsible for delivering that content. And so we automate all of that process of actually getting the content published. And we had this kind of thing. We had no idea how it was going to be done because we didn't know how all these different publishing systems work. So we called this the kind of Magic Elves project. They were going to sit there and beaver away in the background. And there's some very interesting problems. One, getting the media up to the system. If you're going, I need to ask, why don't you have that FTP library in ActionScript? How good would that have been?
There is an FTP library.
There's a half-baked FTP library that seems to have had its development stopped, and there's no confidence that it does large files and resumes.
That's because the API itself doesn't provide the whole how much buffer is left. So at least they improve if they give it more.
That's the one.
That's the result for
you. Yeah. It's always a tough one to get.
So, but if you had we had a project, one of the big things we had for this is we have to build an FTP client that's dedicated for these guys to, because they need to, not like YouTube with a 10 meg file, it's 10 meg to 1.5 gig we have to handle in terms of video transcoding. And so we need to build individual FTP clients. And we thought we could do it in air, deploy it to all these different environments. Thumbs up. Unfortunately, we thought we could do it in Python, God's own language, and total disaster. So we've now written one in Python and Cocoa for Mac, and then there's .NET for Windows, and Unix, we don't know. It's been a painful process, it really has. But air could have been the most beautiful thing in that. I know that's not quite there, but that's
work in progress. Building,
I know.
Something from version 2 or 2,
whatever. Yeah, possibly, yeah. But it just struck me as it really is a...
It's the same concern for downloading files as well.
I just was...
pause and resume.
It's the first project that I've been involved with respect to something like multi-platform deployment and everything else, that AIR just would have been the absolute perfect distribution platform. And clearly, all this talk of Python being cross-platform and Iron Python and .NET, it's all crap. It truly is. It's so hard.
Yeah, but Jeff, you need that one last thing that would have made AIR perfect. I've got a list of probably 50 things.
Yeah.
That would be the one last thing that made AIR perfect.
Yeah. So, well, we're just so close. It was like everything except the actual...
I know. Make sure you yell loud and often. Make sure your rockers and others hear you. They need to hear this stuff. But they do have a long list. And honestly, while that FTP does show up on the list, it's not...
It's not high on the list.
Not the top 20 stuff that shows up regularly. Nowhere near as often as native extensibility and full access to USB and threading and the top 5 that account for 95% of the requests.
Yeah.
But having said that, I agree with you.
Thanks. Feel better now.
Just be a squeaky wheel.
Well, we'll try and be squeaky. I mean, the biggest problem is obviously, it's a project that has to be done.
Yeah.
Could have been high profile.
Yeah, it could have been high profile. Anyway, see you guys.
Tomorrow.
See you tomorrow.
See you guys.
If you go deeper into that going strictly because the alchemy doesn't allow you to mess around with something, so you can use the C and the R.
A lot of people listen to it pretty, but...
It's pretty often protocol.
So what's the exact problem you had about restarts?
Okay, the problem is we need it to work. This is the reality. We looked at it. It didn't do what we needed. So we basically said we would have to write our own FTP client library in ActionScript, and no one could give us any confidence that at the end of the day that we could do it. We didn't want to start on the process of actually building an FTP client and at the end of the day be told, yeah, you know, but because of this issue, you're not going to be able to do that. We're just like, we had to have an FTP client that worked, bang, for the solution. And the problem is you can go to Java, you can go to Python, you can go to any of these languages and bang, you can do FTP. You don't have to really muck around. If you're constructing a client of your own, half the kind of nuts and bolts libraries are there. Well, you would have thought, but...
It's the second one, it's the second stop.
That's the second simple. The thing is, when you're pushing out stuff, you need to know how much buffer space there is, so you can just fill the buffer full and then flush it. And the thing is, ActionScript API doesn't let you know how much buffer has been flushed, so you could be just pumping a lot of data and just consuming a lot of memory.
Oh,
or sometimes the buffer could be empty and it's waiting for you to push things, but you don't know.
Okay, so it's because you can't see the buffer.
Yeah, but there's an input thing, so you know how much bytes there are in the buffer, in the empty buffer. There's nothing for the output buffer. Once you have that, you can do everything. That's what the guy who was building the library for FTP was saying. That's the main reason why it's important.
Some pressure program.
I can see, interesting enough, now having gone through the process, I'm not the developer, it was Rob Rohan's been working on that, or leading up that development. And he's got serious experience across multiple platforms, Unix, Windows, and Mac, for building solutions. He's the guy who wrote C for Clips originally. And it's just fascinating that every time we like hit another roadblock, it's like, oh shit, you know, we tried to do Python in .NET, it just doesn't work. It's an emulation, it's not actually the real thing. We can't do it properly, we're going to have to do it in .NET and call it. But why are we using Python at all? It's like we're using a .NET interface to call Python that calls .NET library. It's just the most maddest thing on earth. Could I throw the whole thing out and write it end-to-end in .NET?
Can I just say, I don't understand why Python is such a nice language. I heard so much good stuff about it. And then I went to look at it, and it was all this self... It made Objective-C look very complete as an object-oriented language.
I'm telling you, it's God's own language. It's the truth. Google have said so. It's where the world is heading.
Fusion is far more oriented, object-oriented than Python.
The weirdest thing they'll get with Python is like, you know how you go print and you could just write curly braces in a string? In Python 3.0 they implemented like you have to have like a proper parenthesis and then do a curly brace, like a proper closing bracket. And everything that had Python 2.5 just broke because printf was just everywhere. And like, this is going to bring everything.
No commercial imperative to make it otherwise. And that's half the problem. But, look, I mean, I say Python's got good strengths and things. I just joke about the fact of being God's own language because it seems to turn up everywhere and we have that joke internally. But, interestingly enough, transforming and transcoding media is difficult. Sending to the individual platforms, interesting, difficult also. So, again, if any of this gets too torturous, let me know because it's 4:20. We can all go and have drinks. But if you're interested, I'm happy to keep pounding on.
How fancy do they want their tools for preparing the video?
So, very good question. So, in terms of... let me just quickly run through the publishing models for the three different points I want to go to. So, actually, the getting of the content to the location. And then I'll just go through all the transcoding stuff. The UNSW TV portal itself, a lot of the questions we get are why do you have a completely separate portal for doing the video when you could just do it through YouTube, or you could just do it through iTunes U, or why do the others when you could do this, and so on. There are very clear reasons why they wanted to publish to all three. It's supposed to be a service rather than, like, here's the portal where you go to for video. It's here's the service you go to transcode your video in a format that will be usable by Blackboard, their LMS solution, be able to be hooked into external parties that might want to showcase a communications video that's being done, you know, a news article, whatever the hell it might be. It's a kind of a point where people can reach and get video. Plus, it will automatically publish to iTunes U and automatically publish to YouTube if you have the appropriate privileges, which is a massive bottleneck for them in terms of getting content out to those third-party providers. And they all have their own communities and their own strengths and weaknesses and so on. So for us, it was just, that's the problem, that's what we have to solve. We ended up with a situation where we had collections of media assets. And in these instances, you know, we have things like the related schools and faculties that they belong to, the author of that particular content. Of course, you can drill down to see the author and all the content they've produced, tags.
What sort of format did you like?
Okay, so encoding, I'll talk about encoding in a sec because there's a huge thing about encoding. In terms of the information architecture, these are just some of the problems we faced. We've got complete control over Unis WTV because we wrote it, so that's great. We can just deliver these things by video. We're using JW Media Player. It's streaming direct off Wowser if you're locally in the LAN of Unis WTV. If you're not, it's automatically geocached via Akamai, and then there's a cache stream that goes straight out to individual users. Setting up Akamai was one of the easiest things on earth. We just changed the way the link was built, and it worked. Didn't have to do anything. It's awesome, wasn't it, really? I mean, the way it works, fabulous. So if you ever have that, it's expensive, mind you, but it's if you've got that problem, then Akamai's great. UNSW, iTunes U, completely different. A completely different publishing metaphor. So, or paradigm. This is the old version of iTunes. If you've got the latest version of iTunes, the iTunes 9, you'll now see iTunes U in the top right-hand corner, but very similar. You can select iTunes U from the standard iTunes store. Underneath that store, there's a kind of a landing page for all things magical that's university stuff. And there's a directory of every single university and college that is participating in iTunes U. It's basically Apple trying to corner this kind of market of distributing university content to a much wider and greater audience. You can podcast and do everything else. Inside your particular area, you can set up your own sections. It's all custom. You have these kind of dividers. There's sections, you know, sections within sections. It's like a kind of a funny sort of XML format for storing that metadata about the hierarchy. But ultimately, so this is it's kind of a section within a section, you end up with a course. And a course in iTunes is effectively a podcast. There's some metadata that describes the course, and you have an RSS feed or an iTunes some supplemented RSS feed that pulls in all of this content. So you have to actually publish all of your content online, have an RSS feed, which then gets pulled into effectively into iTunes. So it's a completely different metaphor from having you go to a website and have it delivered to you. Now in iTunes, you have to have it all pre-prepped and you have it pulled to iTunes, which you then collect from iTunes. And last but not least, YouTube, completely different again. We have this concept of playlists within YouTube. You can't attach a video to a playlist until it's uploaded onto YouTube. So if you want to create a playlist in YouTube, you really need to make sure all your video's gone up there, check that it's all been published, then you can publish the playlist and attach all your videos to it programmatically through their API. So where you've got courses which are drawing an RSS feed, in the case of YouTube, you're actually pushing the video into their system, waiting for it to be published, and then attaching it to. Suffice to say, they're all very different in their mechanism for actually publishing content, and yet we need to come up with some kind of user interface that the average punter can just upload a video and away they go. So uploading the video in the first place is really tough. We started out with a flash uploader. In fact, I think you can get this flash uploader as a form tool render type for upload in Far Cry. Can you still? It's pretty. Looks pretty nasty, I think, unfortunately. There are better versions of this, and I think we probably need to get around to building one. Maybe someone in the community can help us there. there are some jQuery ones with little flash pipes, like a little mini invisible flash thing, you pipe the stuff through. The problem with flash uploaders is that they're only rated by Adobe to do about 100 meg upload, but in actual fact, you know, tests would say that it's probably pretty stable up to about a gigabyte, but it doesn't resume. It has all kinds of problems with, you know, just sort of stopping and hanging, and once you've done 600 meg uploaded through this thing and it stops in the browser, you know, 4 hours has gone by, people are weeping, crying tears of blood. So, yeah, it has to load it into memory, all kinds of problems of that nature. So when you pull that file, the CF file pulls it in and sucks it into memory, and anyway, difficult. So we went to Java, so there's a Java applet, which they can drag and drop files onto this Java applet immediately, causes an upload to happen behind the scenes.
Do you have to have signed a Java applet? Cause
the Java applet is signed, isn't it?
URL, yep.
Yeah, to the URL.
Basically, you had file access with the
Yep, had to grant file access to the Java applet with chunk and liver. And at the end...
Yeah. Does that have any security issues then? So, like, in the context of JavaApp?
Yeah, possibly. But it's the kind of, you know, easiest option at this stage without a dedicated client sitting on their desktop.
And that was something they had in their original application that they requested. What part of the initial specs was, this is what we've got, we do not want this on the new site. This is what we had to replace.
Yeah.
We must have flashed. Flash didn't work out.
Back to interestingly enough, it was, I think, a lot to do with the way in which it was presented to individuals and how they were supposed to interact with it with the rest of the application, other than the actual problem with the Java applet. It works reasonably well, and at the end it does a post. You can get it to do a post back. One of the biggest problems of doing FTP is a disconnect between the file and trying to reconnect it with the user who is actually doing the FTP. So effectively, this does an anonymous FTP to a point, and you need to say, well, this anonymous FTP actually belonged to this particular user. And so you sweep, pick that up and bring it through. We had all this process of... we went through all these processes where you could have a standard FTP client and FTP it up. And as long as you prefixed your file name with your student ID, it would immediately be attached to your particular profile, and away you'd go. That was too hard for people to work with. Just couldn't fathom it.
Why couldn't you build a native sort of a Java application just the way Eclipse works with Suite and JFS? So that looks like
this was one of those things that said, just do it this way, and it was a nothing in the spec. And we went through about five different iterations, and we were getting nothing because it was just one of those things. And we were just trying to come up with a solution to nothing. And then, like you say, we could go ahead and build it, and eventually we just have to say, we will have to build it.
Yeah, a desktop client, and they'd pay for it separately.
So you build it with Python?
So that's what we were talking about. We had Python and Cocoa for OS 10.5 for Leopard. We have to build a new one for Snow Leopard because Snow Leopard basically throws out the old Python and puts in the new Python.
What else are suggesting is using the way Eclipse is built, so you have the suite libraries and then the
Java
libraries, and that would work.
It didn't look like it. What was the reason why you didn't go Java in the end? Apart from the fact that Rob hates the look of Java.
That's an option.
That makes sense.
You can just make a Windows style.
Windows style?
You can make it look like the host controls, so that all the scrolls...
The suite library uses the main...
Does it look good? I don't know. I wasn't involved in the decision for me.
It looks like it is a native application. It tells the native application to make a scroll bar there.
Yep. I think the UI was the least of our problems, actually, in terms of the building of those individual desktop apps, because the UIs are really quite easy to construct.
Suite is just currently a very bad coded UI, but Suite is really well done. It's very performant.
Yeah. Don't know.
So the problem with Flash was that when we're pushing, we can't push. You're just thinking, if the problem was that you don't know how full the output buffer is, if you have something like an XML socket, you could push something into the output buffer, then maybe have your server, whatever the server was that you're setting up, send some sort of acknowledgement back down to say that it's received it.
But the server would be an FTP server.
Do we have to use FTP? Couldn't we make up our own
socket? You know, the biggest problem for us was they said to us, what will it cost to do? And we're like, we don't know if it's possible. No one at Adobe can tell us if it's possible. And our worst-case scenario was, okay, yep, we'll build an ActionScript library for FTP, we'll release it as open source and benefit the community and everything else. Our worst-case scenario was going to be, we go down the path of, 6 weeks of hell, and at the end, somebody says to us, yeah, you're right, it can't be done. And we just couldn't take that risk, so we had to go with something that we knew we could do.
Did it have to be FTP?
Because of the infrastructure, pretty much. I don't know, you would have to build some...
Own socket server or something up on there.
We could have done it. But, we're talking about trying to provide commodity infrastructure for getting these files in place. And FTP is like tried, tested, works, big files, 1.5 gig files. It just doesn't care how big they are. It still works. So, anyway, summary. Java upload is where we ended up with. FTP client is where we're kind of moving towards. These are the sort of FTP clients, interestingly enough. This is the Cocoa app. And really nice, because we're actually building our own client, we interface directly with the system, and it pulls down what we call an upload template, which kind of predetermines certain metadata that's going to be attached to a specific video when it gets uploaded, depending on what school you belong to and all the rest of it. So these sorts of things are quite nice. This is the standard Cocoa app. This is the .NET app, which looks pretty nasty. What did Rob say the other day about .NET app? Jason goes, this looks pretty nasty. Can't we clean up the .NET app? He goes, I don't know how to clean up Windows apps. I don't want to know how. I'm like going, oh, God, here we go. But it's just, it works, looks good.
It looks so bad. Does it, why do you say it looks so bad?
I don't know. I just... You have certain people who don't like Windows or don't like .NET, and everything about it seems to be wrong. It, that's true. And the little crosses and everything on the right-hand side. So when we actually upload something, this is a simplified workflow for the problem that we have with actually doing the uploads. It's more complicated than this. This was one of our initial kind of workflows to try and work this out. We spent a huge amount of time actually sitting down trying to work out every publishing path out to iTunes, out to YouTube, out to our own system, then all the complexities of the infrastructure of having it transcoded elsewhere, brought back, half a dozen different formats, can we store them all the locations, and so on and so forth. You notice podcast producer's still in here, so this was before we went to our own transcoding solution. The reason why I put it up here is because the important thing to get across is that for each individual video item, there's a lot of metadata to collect. It's not like YouTube where you're just throwing something up there and there's one standard transcoding and it's done. We're actually dynamically transcoding either as a kind of a pillar box view or alternatively a widescreen view. We're also attaching things to specific faculties or schools, use certain course codes that you might belong to. If you're in one faculty, you have a different top, you know, the kind of intro to a video, and a different tail, the kind of end outro to a video. Depending on the copyright you've chosen, there are certain publishing restrictions. Like, you can't choose something published under the Act and publish it to YouTube or iTunes U. It's forbidden. You can't do that. So we need to manage all of those permissions for saying, okay, if you're publishing a certain type of copyright, there are certain restrictions to where it can go. Also, we embed a copyright as part of the post-production. So you actually have, then the video comes up and there's a copyright, and then it moves on to something else. So a lot of things going on behind the scenes that actually make and produce that video. In order to try and help this, we built a kind of thing called, we call Mass Transit. This was another sub-project that wasn't part of the original scope of works because they had these huge forms to fill in. They couldn't fill them in all the time. It was too hard. So they wanted to have like a suitcase of metadata you could just attach to a video. You know, I'm uploading my podcast all the time. It's the same transcoding, same headers, footers. It's always the same. Just let me do that. So we built this concept of templates. The other thing that's really cool for this is class assignments. If you're in a class, you go to upload something, you see your upload template, you click on it, automatically assigns it to your course, it secures it so that only people within your course can see it, and provides all of the metadata that the student doesn't need to know anything about it. So in fact, this is a kind of a low fidelity mock-up of how that works. If you're actually a staff member, you would see a kind of general purpose, just upload it to anywhere. Some specialist ones, like upload something that looks good in Blackboard or upload it for a specific course, or create your own, for that matter. As a student, though, you only see those things that for which you can actually participate, course assignments, submissions, and so on. So quite cool. So the transcoding side of it. This was quite interesting. We wanted this concept of a black box, or this was the requirements. You can upload anything you want, anything at all, whether it's audio or video in any format. So it astounds me now, having gone through this process, how many different formats do actually exist, and even within the scope of the same format, how many different variations or parameters can be put into the transcoding of video. The container it sits in, how it's been transcoded, the bit rates, the size of it, the ratios of it. It's kind of a nightmare trying to say, I want to have anything come up and then be reproduced into a universal format. So our vision was to have any kind of mad video uploaded, goes into a black box which magically produces a uniform format that we can use in all of these publishing destinations we want to go to. And this is what Apple promised us with the podcast producer, this kind of magical thing that was going to work. And off the record, apparently one of the engineers involved in the project said to them, don't use the product, it's not ready for prime time. If you do, you'll embarrass us if it goes out to large-scale production because it won't be able to do what it is that you're trying to do with it. So that put a huge spanner in the works. Apparently the next release of it will be fine, but it's a year on now, so a year ago we just weren't ready for it. We went to FFmpeg, which is a open-source binary or sources which you can compile to a binary, depending on what you want, that does video transcoding. This in itself, we went through, Amazon, beautiful environment. You've got EC2, bring up as many computers as you like. We went through a 32-bit version of FFmpeg on Linux and Windows and Mac, a 64-bit version on Linux and Windows, but also Mac because we run those on the desktop. Which is better? How do they perform better? Should we have X number of CPUs? We have 16 CPUs in a box, or just two CPUs, or one CPU, or... what is going to be the most efficient mechanism for actually transcoding bulk amounts of video? And as it turns out, it depends. It depends on how you compile FFmpeg. There are all kinds of libraries that you can compile into your FFmpeg binary, which depend on what output you want at the end of the day, and so on. So we had to do a lot of testing to try and decipher what would actually be useful, and we even provide UNSWTV with the option of passing in their own config string to instruct our FFmpeg binary how to work. Incidentally, I think the result was 32-bit, surprisingly, because there are a bunch of libraries inside the binary which are 32-bit, and when they start getting emulated under a 64-bit implementation, it slows things down. And we restrict it to a few, only a couple of threads on a small box. So we went through the kind of Uber box. What was the biggest box we brought up? 18 or something? Some enormous amount of memory and enormous number of CPU units, and it just wasn't efficient. So having a lot of small boxes running 32-bit Ubuntu was our best kind of variation for what we wanted to do.
So how many small boxes?
So we currently run a static farm of 4 boxes, which we can increase to any size. We have the Amazon load balancer, which just splits that across all these things. We use Python to accept the calls, do all the stuff, and invoke the FFmpeg, and then return the results, and to shift all the files out to Amazon S3 for storage. Interesting enough, the next phase of the project, which we're now moving back internally into the university infrastructure, but the next phase of the project was going to try and set up a kind of, you know, Skynet style. You can measure the performance of those boxes in the transcoding farm, and if they're all very quiet, you can turn boxes off. And if it's very, very busy, you can magically turn boxes on. So you could just create a farm of 25 machines all pounding away if you have assignments, you know, 100 assignments uploaded overnight. But then when it's, you know, during the holidays, you might only have 2 boxes sitting there on standby just processing stuff as it comes through. So that was the kind of vision that we were going for, but it's currently on hold at the moment. We called this the Autobot, which is basically the good transformers. So the way we went through transforming is to first of all do basing, where we essentially create this kind of universal format where, depending on, you know, could come in half a dozen different sizes. A lot of the stuff are lecturers screen capturing their monitors, and so you get all the different pixel variations that you get from half a dozen different screen sizes that are out there, and we kind of base that into a certain size. It's the same size as our tops and tails. Interestingly enough, we dynamically introspect the video to see whether it's, you know, like a widescreen or a boxy type video, and then apply a different config to it. So there's all this kind of clever stuff, because we couldn't rely upon users to actually make even the simplest choice of, I want it to be widescreen or I want it to be something else. Once it's been based, we stitch them all together. So we do this merging and stitching. So the tops and tails, and there's also a copyright slices in there. We stitch them all together and retranscode them all into the final format that we want, which I think from memory was a kind of a high, near high definition MP4. Be correct, wouldn't it? Yeah. Actually, we produce a couple. We produce one specifically for iTunes, one specifically for YouTube, and a high def one specifically for streaming. Which, yeah, interesting in its own right, but. These guys have big videos, 1.5 gig file. I don't care what the infrastructure is. It's just a menace to deal with. 1.5 gigs can take... We're just having transformation. We still do sometimes when they do some weird thing. They go into Premiere or do something where they export it and they've done something crazy in the video. Plays fine, everything's good. Hits the transcoder and 5 days later it pops out.
5 days?
You know, it's the longest we've had something run for. Can't be that long, can't it? And it's because what they're trying to do is a transfer. Like, they may have super high def thing and a funny kind of ratio or whatever, and it goes through this basing process to bring it all down, try and maintain its integrity and the fidelity of the data, and then it brings it back out to what it was, and it just takes so long to churn through it. And they can make a change to their export, you know, tag this thing, and it takes 30 minutes or something. Well, not quite 30 minutes, probably an hour. But the problem that we face is you have all these different things going on at different times. File storage, for example, could take us anywhere from seconds to hours to move files around in the system. because you've got a 1.5 gigabyte file, transferring it from S3 to Unis WTV's network to stream,
or from their local server
up, can take a long time. And you have to keep testing to see if it's there. Transcoding different formats, the kind of all these problems we had with the FFmpeg farm, can take minutes to hours, stroke days in some instances. iTunes U, the web server, sometimes just not there. Or it can take seconds to minutes to respond. YouTube, completely different. FTP, they do their own transcoding, which, depending on how busy YouTube is, can take anywhere from minutes to hours. And also we have a web service via this sort of GData process or GData protocol where we constantly keep polling to confirm whether or not our YouTube video has arrived and been transcoded. They don't kind of notify you in any way. You have to actually check. Is it finished transcoding yet? And all the problems you can imagine.
With iTunes, you don't see that. It's not there. What happens with Facebook is if it's going for maintenance, when you make an API call, it returns the data, but it returns you with nothing, so you feel like it's not there. So I was just making my own really simple Facebook application that basically I take some bunch of photos, put it in a special folder, and there's a service listening, and automatically uploads them to Facebook.
Yep.
What once happened is Facebook took the profile for maintenance, so when the API made a call, there's no data, so the app just took all the photos and re-uploaded them. And when Facebook came back, you had like two folders of each of the albums.
Yeah.
Like, what happened?
Yeah. And they don't tell you half the time what the response will be if there's a failure. You just have to discover it in the middle of, you know, burning fire, everything falling in a scrap heap. So we had all these notes. I mean, it was good. We just managed to, we had photos of all the individual notes that we'd taken in the cafe and wherever the hell you might be, building out exactly how we're going to sort of build the sort of publishing solution. And then we went to putting all this through. I think we used OmniGraphle probably for many of these kind of workflows to determine how all the different workflows worked. And then we had to pitch exactly how we were going to approach this before we went into the build, because there are all kinds of unknowns, especially when we start looking at some of the detailed things that just weren't obviously weren't going to work. So this kind of swim lane diagram kind of represents, I can't remember, it was probably fairly accurate actually, all the different kind of events that are taking place and the different third parties that are involved in that transaction. So from Far Cry, which was kind of the administrative side of things, managing things, Unis WTV portal, transcoding server, and the individual publishing points. How do we manage this? The hardest thing is they're all asynchronous processes, the whole lot. I think I probably have a couple of slides here. Yeah. So we had a simple message queue. We built a Far Cry plugin, which we started off, we said we don't need a message queue. We'll get by without a message queue. We don't want to go to JNS or anything like that. So we'll manage those events in the table. And of course, every time they kept coming up with a new problem, we kept adding functionality to our simple message queue, to the point where it actually became a very sophisticated message queue for handling all of these individual asynchronous tasks. Incidentally, we used just a standard database table or a couple of different database tables, content types, incidentally, for managing the individual events or messages that were being fired. We used the asynchronous gateway in ColdFusion to queue these events. So we'd have a process that would go through and say, are there any events to be queued? Queue them. They go through the queue. There's a scheduled task that would re-queue events that needed escalating, perhaps. You know, something's failed multiple times, we might want to do something. All the sorts of things that we would do for rescheduling, which are interesting for escalation. You might say, if it fails once, try it again in 5 minutes. If it fails again, try it again in an hour. If it fails again, try it again in a day. If it fails again, then, you know, alert everybody that there's a really serious problem going on. Because we don't know if it's us that's failing or whether it's a third party that's failing. There's a lot of different moving parts. So we had a central, call it a central dispatcher, but essentially the small message queue would funnel off these events to this dispatcher, which would, you could register a series of listeners, each of which is just a ColdFusion component, that would look at the message coming from the dispatcher and decide whether it needed to process it or not, pick it up and do something with it. So I might be listening for transformation events here at Autobot, or listening for iTunes publishing events, and so on. So a little bit simplistic in terms of the overview, but I think hopefully get the idea. The basic things that we got back from building a message queue is you need to log everything. You never kind of see events happening, because they can happen at any time. You can't see anything in the interface, if you know what I mean. So you have to log everything that happens. So we log when events start, when they finish, if anything goes wrong inside them, even some kind of progress that might be happening in that event, and so on. Requeuing events, if the system drops dead and everything keeps failing against that, you need to easily be able to say, yep, I expect that YouTube will not be available at some point. So we need to be able to just requeue all those events quite easily and have it retry against YouTube when it comes back up, or when iTunes comes back up. We had all these nice little message queue logs. It's quite cool. You can now, as a user, when you go in, if there's a transcoding event and it's failed, you can see the progress of the transcoding, and if it failed, it gives you the report, sometimes very cryptic, as to why the transformation failed. You know, blah, 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 lib, such and such. They go, what? But at least it gives the people who are actually in charge of the transcoding configs an idea of what's going on. Generally speaking, to the average contributor, we try and keep that as simple as possible, just to say it failed and you need to escalate it to whoever is your particular administrator. So this moves on to, you know, why we went through EC2, S3, and just interesting to see the sorts of things we were using. We used Microsoft SQL Server, probably because I think that was our preferred and their preferred database environment. We're happy to use any environment. It's just, it's good to match up with the client what they like. Ubuntu is our flavour of Linux that we prefer at the moment. It's good, isn't it? I like Ubuntu. So FFmpeg Farmers and that could have well have been probably in any Linux products, but Ubuntu's nice Debian derivative and pretty stable and good. Windows 2008, that's the video portal server. That's really just the Far Cry app, the website that's being delivered. And again, that was a choice based on the internal preferences of the client. And this file storage in S3 is a beautiful thing. It has all kinds of options for you. There's a thing called Jungle Disk, which you can use to sync your files and do all sorts of magic. Have you seen Jungle Disk? Don't use it in a production environment. It's there are some limitations that you don't really come up against until it really matters. And you're moving big files and need to sync files, and it's great as a personal desktop application, but it is not great as a server-based solution. Not when we... They might now. But it may well be because of all the complaints we've made. There are all kinds of problems. And to be fair to them, it's like, it wasn't designed for that, so why are you trying to torture our product into doing that? And it's open source. If you want to do something, we're like, look, there are other options we can go to. So for moving all the big stuff, that's when we moved the farm. It just happened to be at the same time we moved the farm to Python, and a lot of those problems, we started using the AWS API directly, the Amazon's own API, without going through a third party. And this is this diagram I was showing you before, moving all the files around. Secure streaming, cache streaming, also downloads going out to iTunes, and so on and so forth. That's it. Marvellous. Built in Far Cry Core. Wonderful, marvellous application framework. So the initial build was 12 weeks. We pretty much based all of our projects on a 12-week cycle. It wasn't built in 12 weeks. That's probably... It was coded in 12. And so we started in November. We finished in February, pretty much. So November, December, January. Beginning of February, we launched the first pilot. And we had all kinds of problems. Actually, very few with the application, and predominantly with infrastructure. So we had all kinds of FFmpeg problems and transcoding reliability and so on, which became a completely separate project, because you imagine podcast producer was a disaster. It was just thrown out completely. We had to rewrite the app to interface with the new transformer. But because of the message queue, it was beautiful. As far as we're concerned, we throw a message onto an event onto the message queue, and it comes around and gets picked up by whatever happens to be the transcoding server. And if it's podcast producer today and FFmpeg tomorrow, it didn't really matter. It was a really nice, argument for the message queues and how beautiful they can be.
Well, that's the whole point about batch processing. People always sort of write off the banks and stuff for being very staid and just actually having files that get transferred and dumped into one process. But it's all just about temporal decoupling.
That's it.
In a bank, you've got 800 different systems and they're never going to be all up at the same time. And you can't have, we're just used to, in this web world, of having everything being online and going and calling online web services and stuff, which is just not realistic in a big complex environment.
Yeah.
In addition to that, the batch stuff is long run requests, you're in trouble with 2 seconds.
Yeah, exactly. You can't just use up CPUs sitting around waiting for stuff quickly.
With your streaming issues, have you had a chance to look at 10.1?
To look at what, sorry?
Flash 10.1.
Flash 10.1, the player?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Are there any specific problems?
Well, no, there's a new feature coming out.
Oh, the HTTP streaming. One, we have to support lower flash players for just in general kind of ubiquitous of the player. But two, we don't have a great deal to do with the choices in terms of what they do for streaming. So they manage the streaming server and we effectively deliver content to it.
When you say
HTTP streaming server, what does that mean? You don't have to use the RTMP streaming stuff. You can actually do it via HTTP.
So you just make a call to a special URL that gives you a small, like, 1 minute video?
I don't know how it actually delivers those chunks out to you, but I presume something like that. It's been around for ages. There's been a couple of Apache mods that will do what they call light streaming or something for these sorts of things that are not RTMP but are via the HTTP stream. And I don't know how successful they are. I haven't had any. The one thing that was interesting to us for that was that Apple iPhone will stream via that HTTP streaming connection. So completely separate to Flash, but something that we were interested in looking at because they're interested in building an iPhone app to render their videos like kind of YouTube on their iPhone, but for the Unis WTV portal. Maybe a vanity project. I don't know how important that is to them at the moment, but it's kind of on hold until they sort out the next budget type thing. But yeah, absolutely. I think it surprised me that they were so reluctant to help us with Flash Media Server. We could do it ourselves now. We're a direct, it's kind of a reseller that can sell Flash Media Server, but it's too late. We're kind of way down the path. We could have done a deal or whatever else, but they're just not agile enough in that particular respect.
We've lost three projects since Rocket Boot started which were going to include media service because we couldn't even get the pricing. After weeks, we couldn't even find what the actual SKU was to order the right version of media service.
And nobody knows.
No one knew. We once got a... You were there, I think, when Chris Hock was in Australia, and we put the... I said, this is the best we could get after 3 weeks. This is the Pat, who used to be operations manager of Asia Pacific, from Macromedia, so he's not helping anyone else. And all we could get, and he just laughed and said, oh, that's funny, that's the spreadsheet I just gave someone one day. It's a sort of temporary sort of thing, but there was no information in the channel. They gave you a list of 200 codes, no actual description of what it is, and a price, and there's a no return policy. So if you spend $8,000 and it's not the right thing, then...
And there's all kinds of, there's edge caching servers and things, and you're like, there's no one to simply... The problem is all these other products out there, there's just... This is it, you can deploy it, and away you go. It might not do the volume that the Flash Media Server is going to do. But these guys are like, might not do that, but we're not doing that volume today. And if we do it tomorrow, we might talk to you, or we might talk to our provider that's provided us with this dinky solution that just does what we ask. I think the biggest turn-off for Unis WTV, to be honest, is that they looked at Flash Media Server, and it was just like, yeah, we don't want to do all that, we just want to stream. And so you could do that in Flash. And that's what I say, why isn't there just like a Flash Media Server light that just does the streaming?
There is the streaming one.
But that's not the way it's sold, and it's not the way it's articulated. And in our instance, we couldn't kind of talk to them. It was like, oh, you need to talk to the educational provider. Who is it? The John Treloar's team, or old team, to talk about an education license for the university to do something. And I'm like, this and this, if this goes out beyond this project, that's it, it's over. And in fact, it's exactly where it went. It just went nowhere. They just went, this works today. I just pressed a button and it appeared on Amazon EC2. Too easy.
So,
did
I understand that this project you did 12 weeks?
This project we did the first pilot released in February. So, yes, we had a huge amount of preparatory work up front. Yep, and then to build, it was a very aggressive build. But the client was actually very good with the fact that they call it internally, they have different types of project terminology at the university. I don't know if it's a common thing, but there's a thing called a pilot program where you have a kind of an endpoint and you're kind of testing that something's going to work and you implement a pilot program as like a small run version. And that wasn't this type of project because they normally have a fixed budget in place and that's it. At the end of the pilot program, you're making a decision as you're going further or not. This was a discovery project, which meant they had a budget to be able to prototype a solution, which then might lead on to a pilot to implement a solution. And so we had a lot of support.
It's a pretty mature process.
Yeah, I thought it was a very mature process too, because the transcoding thing alone would have knocked many projects just straight on the head like that. Regardless of all our work, can't transcode, Apple's fallen over, that's it, the whole project's dead in the water. And they just went, okay, new budget, totally separate project, transcoding. And so for us, we wrote all that in ColdFusion instantly at first. And it just wasn't working for us, unfortunately. ColdFusion is many things, but it's not a transcoding service.